Evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're very honored this evening to have Rabbi Kahn here from Yerushalayim, who is an international speaker, known all over the world, to be honest. And in no small part, thanks go to Amanda Bradley for organizing, for pushing us to have this event. And by the turnout, I'm really happy that you did. Thank you, Amanda. Rabbi Kahn works in numerous institutions. He lives in Yerushalayim. He's very involved in Aish. He's involved in Matan, numerous other institutions. And he's agreed to speak to us this evening on a subject that's entitled Esther, the Hidden Story, which presumably is some sort of very early introduction to Purim, but I might be wrong. So without further ado, I'd like to call on Rabbi Kahn and welcome him to speak to Netzach. Thank you.
So, Amanda, I hope you didn't have to push people too hard, or maybe that explains why they came. Yes, it's an early introduction to Purim for a very simple reason, and that is that we have passed Tu B'Shvat, and having passed Tu B'Shvat, it means that we were almost a whole year since last Purim. But as you know, we have more than one Adar this year. And you say, Mishenichnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha. So apparently this year we need more Simcha than we need in other years. So the main aspect of the Simcha, the joy of Adar, is really the story of Purim. So we will discuss Purim this year longer than we will discuss in other years. Very, very simple. However, the story of Purim is not a happy story. The holiday, the story of Esther at least, is not a happy story. And the one thing that I hope is that by the time I finish tonight, I don't completely ruin the story for you and that you'll never look at it the same. And Purim is a happy day. The story of Esther is not a happy story. It's a sad story that has a happy ending. But even the happy ending is very bittersweet. One of the things that we do before we get to Purim is that we need to fast, and we have a fast Tainus Esther. Even though the fast day itself is not mentioned in Tanakh, it's not mentioned, for that matter, according to most Rishonim, at all in rabbinic literature, which I'm defining as Mishnah, Gemara, Tosefta, Braisa, Midrashim, not mentioned Tainus Esther. The fast itself is something which the Jewish community does, which we did over the years, and sort of just happened. But the reason it happened is what I already told you, and that is that Purim is not necessary, or the story of Esther is not necessarily a happy story, and before we read it, we end up feeling that we need to fast. So I will explain everything I just now said, hopefully in a way which is understood. What was the exact title? Esther, the Hidden Story, which is, of course, not the title that I wanted, but I was... No, I was censored, so, but it's okay. You'll find out that you can only censor my titles, but you can't censor what it is that I'm going to say. So, and actually, I didn't know that the building that we're going to come in and speak in is something which is a building used by Aish. I thought after the talk I gave 2 weeks ago, the word would be out and Aish would not let me in any place. And any of you who heard that lecture on the web will know what I'm talking about. When I gave a talk in Los Angeles 2 weeks ago on Have the Rabbis Ruined Judaism? Which, by the way, wasn't a one-word answer. It was somewhat more nuanced and a little bit more complex. So if you're interested, you will be able to find that lecture fairly easily. So let's understand the story. The way that we learn it as kids is that there once upon there was a nice Jewish girl and she won a beauty contest, and that is the miracle of Purim, right? Okay, maybe I didn't say that properly. Not that a Jewish girl could not win a beauty contest without divine intervention. That's not what I intended to say. But the point is that, in fact, it was not really a beauty contest, was it? Now the backdrop of the story, when I say the backdrop of the story, what I mean is the subtext of the whole story, the background of the story. There's something hovering above, and when we read it, we don't necessarily get it, and you need to pay attention. And every single time it says in the Megillah, Shushan Habira, Shushan the capital, you need to understand something, that Shushan is not supposed to be our capital. We have a different capital. And what capital is that? What is our capital? I know that you're in England and you listen to the BBC, but what is the undivided capital? You can't guess this answer. I know I've been told British audiences can't answer because you're all too shy and you think you may get a wrong answer. So you know what? You will. It's okay. You'll get wrong answers. But this one's easy. And what's the answer? See that? Big answer. This time. Okay. I was warned. We'll see. The Jews were supposed to be in Yerushalayim then. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting to try to look back historically when the story takes place. The story takes place after we started to build the second Beis HaMikdash, and it was stopped. And it was stopped, and the Jews who... Why are they there? Why are they in Shushan? Because these are some of the people that chose not to come back. These are some of the people that made this unbelievable historical decision, and despite the fact that they could all move to the land of Israel, decided they wanted to stay behind. By the way, somebody asked me back where I live in Israel, they said, when you travel to Chutz La'aretz, to the diaspora, do you tell people they should be in Israel? And I said, of course I tell them that. And they say, they let you speak? I said, of course they let me speak. So if you notice any historical parallels with what's going on today, the Jews had an opportunity to come back to the land of Israel, and certain people remarkably decided that maybe it would be better if they stay in some other major, what they perceive to be a major empire. By the way, I don't have to tell you. Okay, anyway. The empire is not doing so good. Anyway. And they stayed behind. And not only that, according to the Gemara, and what I'm going to do for the rest of this evening, I am going to weave in the text of the Megillah together with rabbinic interpretation. Rabbinic interpretation from the Midrash, from the Gemara, from the Zohar, and we will again see how much you behave, how far I can get. But the Gemara says that the celebration that Ahasuerus made was a celebration of the fact that he understood that the Jews will not succeed and have not succeeded, cannot succeed in rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. And the center of the world is going to remain Shushan and not Yerushalayim. And the fact that the Jews come in, and now you remember this custom that we have, V'kelim, V'kelim, what do we... We sing those words using the utensils. Which utensils? The utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. Matter of fact, there's a Medrash that says that Ahasuerus dressed up as the... See the answer. He dressed up as the Kohen Gadol. He dressed up as the Kohen Gadol and says, that's it, there's no longer Beis HaMikdash. But the fact that the Jews can come and partake of this is absolutely unbelievable. Okay. Now, I'm not going to tell you the whole story. You know the story. The story of the Megillah is, if you want to put it down like in one sentence, you know, somebody very brilliant once said that the old Jewish holidays are the same, they tried to kill us, they didn't succeed, let's eat, right? So Purim would be let's drink. So there's a slight change in that. Over here, the story of Purim is a different story. It's the story of a man who killed his wife because of the advice of his best friend and then killed his best friend because of the advice of his wife. Right? That's the whole story. Right? I just ruined you the end of the book. That's should have had a spoiler warning over here. That's what the whole story is, right? Which right there you appreciate this irony, and this very interesting parallelism which takes place between the relationship between Ahasuerus and Vashti and Haman and Esther and Mordechai. And again, they're something interesting with the various characters. Now, the word that I was not allowed to use, which was originally the title but got taken away, am I allowed to use the word or no? It starts with an F. And, no, it's not that. It's feminism. It's worse than that. It's in American, I don't know if you know such a thing exists, American feministic literature, they love the story of Esther. You know why they love the story of Esther? Because they find a real feminist there. Who's the real feminist in the story? Vashti. Vashti's the great feminist. Why is she a great feminist? Because she gets killed. No. Why is she a great feminist? Because she tells a man to go and she refuses. And therefore she refuses. Therefore she represents the strong female type. And it's not a proper read of the book. And one of the things we need to be careful about, when I wrote my first book, and I really did this with authentic humility. I approached a certain rabbi and I asked him if he would write a haskama for my book. His name was Rabbi Bulman. I don't know if any of you know him. I asked Rabbi Bulman, you write haskama. And Rabbi Bulman said to me, you don't want my haskama. It doesn't mean anything anymore. He goes, I've given it to so many people. It's meaningless, completely meaningless. And I said, you don't understand. When I say to you, I want a haskama, I'm saying that if you say this book is not worthy, I won't publish it. I'm not looking for a letter that I can write in the book that will help sell more. People don't even read the book. I mean, they don't read the intro. I said, I want you to tell me if you think that what I wrote here is authentic or not authentic. What's one of the stumbling blocks that we have when we try to have authentic ideas? We come from a certain time and place, philosophy, and we take our own personality and our own biases and read them back into ancient texts. You have to be careful. Anybody who thinks that Vashti was a feminist absolutely does not understand the book. Not only don't understand the book, they don't understand ancient Persia. There were no feminists in ancient Persia. I mean, are there feminists in Iran today? They're not doing all that well if they are. I mean, just consider this for a second. The story is not about feminism. The story is about something else completely. And this will help us understand the first character. First character is Vashti. Why does Vashti have so much anger? See, it's interesting. In the beginning of the story, Ahasuerus makes a party. He drinks. He's happy. He's celebrating. And Vashti makes a party. Now, is Vashti's party the same party as Ahasuerus' party? Now, this is something we can get confused about. So, therefore, I know that a lot of you have done a lot of work on this, research on this, personal research on this in the past. You don't know what my question is going to be. Why do people drink? Now, all those years of research will come into, why do people drink? People drink because they're happy, and people drink because they're sad. My understanding is Ahasuerus is happy, Vashti is not. Why? Because like many other people, they had a dysfunctional relationship. Why do they have a dysfunctional relationship? Well, we need to go a little bit further to understand that. Vashti is not head over heels in love with Ahasuerus. So let us pause for a second and understand why. According to rabbinic literature, Ahasuerus did not come from royalty. There are different midrashim, different expressions, who exactly he was. Consensus is he worked in the stable, which means Ahasuerus is walking in the stable. He does not get near the royal family. He cleans up from the horses of the royal family. That's what he does. But sitting there in the stable, he looks up and he sees the palace. And by the way, I did research for this today. We went to Buckingham Palace and we took a look. He looks at the palace from afar and he says, I did not say this morning. He says, one day this will be mine. And he looks at the king's daughter and he says, one day she will be mine. Now he accomplishes this. How does he accomplish this? In the good old-fashioned way. How? By having a military coup and killing the former regime. What happens when you have a coup? You take the spoils. What do the spoils include? The spoil includes the palace, it includes the home, it includes the female residents of the home. When we read in the beginning of the story, the fear that his advisors have, you better do something about your wife, because if you don't, then none of our wives will listen to us, which is what got the feminists all excited. Nothing to do with feminism. It has to do with class. The women were all women who were aristocratic, and the men were all of these soldiers who took them by force. And Vashti really has to make a choice. What is her choice? Am I going to continue to be humiliated by this man day after day? He killed my family. He took what was mine. Or at some point does she say, enough of you. I refuse. What price does she pay for that? She pays a price. She pays with her life. But basically, what's her answer when he says, come here and let me show off your beauty? What price does he pay? What price does she pay? She says to him, over my dead body. What does he say? He says, by the way, he doesn't want to kill her. Why doesn't he want to kill her? Because she's the one who gives him. She is the one who has royalty. She's aristocracy. She is like having the palace itself, having the throne itself. Killing her is something he doesn't want to do, but she gives him no choice. And all the others say, you better do something, or all of us are going to lose our position. Is that clear? Now, the reason why this is important, because it leads us up to the next problem. Now, the thing that happens next is that he needs a new wife. And by the way, it wasn't that a man like Ahasuerus had a lack of companionship. That was the easy part. His advisor comes with a great plan to make this beauty contest. It's not a regular beauty contest, and I hope you all appreciate that. What was the contest itself? What was the contest? That now you can't say this, because this is a little embarrassing. I know that you can't say this. What was the contest? The contest was one where each woman comes in the evening and leaves in the morning, and you understand the innuendo. All of the women who are in this contest remain in the harem afterwards. The only question is, who's going to win and who's going to remain and become his wife? Now, Esther is taken, which is really the situation of Esther. The whole first half of the book, Esther is passive. The turning point of the book is when Esther becomes active, which means so much for the feminists not seeing within Esther a hero. And by the time, before I finish, I will try to get to the Zohar, what the Zohar says about Esther, which is absolutely beyond the imagination of anybody in the room right now. But what happens is that Esther seems to be, at best, conflicted. And not only conflicted. Do you think Esther wants to win the contest? How do I know that she doesn't want to win? It's not just ambivalence. All the other women ask for something. All the women ask for perfume. I don't know what they looked like before, but 6 months, or smelled like before, 6 months of perfume and 6 months of makeup. Okay, maybe they needed it. I don't know. Esther asks for nothing. Again, the people in charge give her something, throw something on. Why does Esther win? So you could say because she's a natural beauty, because there's something else about her. Esther is ambivalent. All the other women, how do you think they played their card, as it were? All the other women were probably very interested in winning. Esther, and this is message for young women all over. Esther plays hard to get. Why does she play hard to get? This is a very simple question. Because she is hard to get. Okay? Try that again. Esther plays hard to get because she is hard to get. It's not a game. She has no interest whatsoever in winning this contest. I mean, as far as she's concerned, her life is over. And by the way, I do have to ask a question, which maybe doesn't seem all that obvious to you, but is very obvious to me and should be obvious to you at this point. Does Esther have a choice? Don't shake your head no. I wouldn't ask the question if it was no. Does Esther have a choice? Of course she has a choice. And how do I know she has a choice? Because the previous character who she's replacing made a choice. And what was the choice? Over my dead body. Esther could have made the same choice. Esther could have said, over my dead body, I absolutely refuse. And what would have happened? She would have been killed. And by the way, what would be the advantage of being killed? Would have ruined the Purim spirit. But what would be the advantage of being killed? She dies pure. She becomes a martyr. Olam Haba. Years later, we would still be speaking of this Esther who died al Kiddush Hashem and refused to be involved in such a thing. And instead, Mordechai encourages her to be involved. And there's no prophecy at this point. She does not know exactly what it is that she's supposed to be doing. She carries along as if there may be some kind of divine plan without any instruction. You know, there's an incredible medrash that I want to read to you that describes Esther's state of mind religiously. The Gemara tells us that the 22nd Psalm, Perikuf Beis in Tehillim, is about Esther. That's the Psalm, of course, that says, Keili, Keili, lama azavtani. My God, why have you forsaken me? Listen to the words of the Midrash in Tehillim. Keili, Keili, lama azavtani. My God, why have you forsaken me? Keili b'yamsuf, my God who was there at the splitting of the sea. Lama azavtani. Sorry, I skipped a word. Keili b'yamsuf, keili b'sinai. And my God who was there at Sinai. Lama azavtani. Why have you abandoned me? What's the point of the Midrash? God appeared at Sinai and God appeared at the splitting of the sea. What does God do at the splitting of the sea? One word answer, salvation. That even though the situation was dire, man was saved. Am Yisrael was saved. She says, God, where were you? Continue. What is Sinai? Revelation. God, talk to me. The Midrash continues and says, Lama nishtanu alai sidro shalolam. Why regarding to me, Esther says, has the rules of the world changed? Visiduran shel imahos. And the rules of the matriarchs. Uma imenu sara al yedei shenishbeis al paru layla echas lokohu v'chol beiso. Sarah was in the house of Paro one night. What happened that night? What does the Midrash say? An angel came out with a 2x4, smacked Paro up the side of the head. What does he say? I have a headache, I'm not in the mood. And the whole palace was struck with plagues. And what happens? Sarah is saved. Sarah is there for one night, and she is saved. Lokohu v'chol beiso. Shenemai v'negash yemes Paro negin gdolim ves beiso. Ani. And then she says, but by me. She'ani nisuna v'soch chiko sha'osa rasha kol hashanim halalu. Ein ata osa ime nisim. And she says, God, I've been stuck in the grasp of this evil man for all these years, and for me you have no miracles left. Keili, keili, lama azavtani. My God, why have you forsaken me? You haven't done your miracles, and you haven't told me what you want. And remember, till this point we had prophecy. Till this point in time we were told by the Nevi'im, we're told what God wants of us. And suddenly, the communication is shut down. God does miracles for people, no miracles, no communication. She continues and says, quotes another verse in the same Perek of Tehillim, Pasuk Yud Aleph, which says, Mi beten imi keli ata, for my mother's womb you've been my God, I've never abandoned you. Lama shalosh pa'amim, why does it say my God three times? Amra Esther v'nei Kadosh Baruch Hu, Esther said to God, Ribono shalolam, master of the universe, shalosh mitzvah nasatali, you've given me as a Jewish woman three commandments, nida v'chala v'hadlaka saner. Afal pishani bebayis rashazeh klum avarti el echas mehem. Even though I've been in this wicked man's home all these years, I've never broken even one of these. And the Gemara explains that Esther would go to mikveh before the rape was perpetrated on her body. The Gemara and the Midrash are telling us that Esther's neshama is absolutely pure, even though her body was violated. That's what Chazal is telling us. Does she have complaints? Absolutely she has complaints. She turns to God and says, what in the world is going on over here? Why are things different? When I said it's a sad story, think about it. Here's a girl. This is what she wants? Of course it's not what she wants. And how do I know it's not what she wants? I'm saying it again. How do I know? Completely ambivalent. Doesn't ask for anything. Doesn't want anything. She doesn't want to win. Now, why does she win the contest? She wins it because she's so ambivalent to him. She wins it because she's so standoffish from him. And here's another secret. What do men want? What they can't have. Does Ahasuerus want all of these other Persian women who are throwing themselves at him? No, those are easy. Which one does he want? The one that doesn't want him. And how does he read her ambivalence? It reminds him of somebody. You know who it reminds him of? It reminds him of Vashti. Which means he sees within Esther this regal personality. He sees within Esther this aristocracy. He sees within Esther something which is holy. And he can't have it. There's something hidden about her. She won't even say who she is. And this complete disinterest on her part is one of the great ironies of the story, is exactly the reason that Esther ends up winning. So far, so good? Not a happy story. And year after year, Esther is stuck. And then things get worse. Because how do things get worse? Because then Haman decides to kill all the Jews. Now, Haman is a complete lunatic. He's out of his mind. Matter of fact, I can diagnose him. I only have a first degree in psychology, but I can still diagnose him. Haman is what we would have called a long time ago, we would call him manic depressive. Today they would call him bipolar, a little Prozac. He would have been fine. How do I know that? You take a look at him. His highs are high and his lows are low. When he gets energized, he can't stop, and he's probably an incredible person, very creative. But when he hits lows, he hits very real, incredible lows. Hold on to Haman for a second, and let's talk about Ahasuerus again. What do you know about Ahasuerus? Well, I'll tell you one thing we know about him, and that is that he's absolutely paranoid. If you think about it, you can think of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different indications that he's paranoid. Why? Give me one law that he has that indicates he's paranoid. You can't come in and see him without an invitation. If you come and see him without an invitation, that's a death sentence. Okay, there's something really wrong about that. Haman realizes that he's paranoid. What does Haman say? There's a group out there that want to do bad things for the king. Okay, kill them all. Who are they? Doesn't care. By the way, the one other good thing about paranoia, as somebody once said, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean no one's out to get you. There are people out to get him. But why ultimately is he paranoid? Because this is the price that he pays for his own behavior. What was his own diabolical behavior? That he sat in the stable, looking at the palace, and saying, one day this will be mine. And now what does he realize? That there must be somebody else sitting in the stable, and sitting in the kitchen, and sitting every other place around, looking at every one of them, saying, which one of these people are plotting to get rid of me? He's spending all of his time worried about this. Which means Ahasuerus is completely paranoid. Haman is a megalomaniac He's a megalomaniac who is bipolar. And Esther, this nice, sweet, innocent girl, has to take them both on. And she comes up with a plan which is just so simple and so brilliant and so obvious. What does she do? She plays off the megalomania of Haman against the paranoia of Ahasuerus. Right? Very simple plan. She goes over to Ahasuerus, and this is the first time she's reached out to him. Right? This is the first time. And she reaches out to him. And what's Ahasuerus thinking? Aha, finally she came around. She's inviting me over. She's never done that before. I mean, the Gemara says that every time till this point had a halachic status of rape. Why? Because she was taken against her will. The implications of her now going willfully are theologically and religiously absolutely devastating. Because now she's going in, and again, let's grow up. When she walks in to see Ahasuerus, what does she do before she walks in? Now she puts on a little makeup. Now she puts on a little perfume. Over here? I don't know. She fasts for 3 days.
Not very attractive.
I wouldn't know. I would assume 3 days she fasted, not at night, otherwise she would die. And by the way, there's a beautiful medrash about this, which I'm not answering the question, I'm just sort of making believe I didn't hear it. But there's a beautiful medrash that when she fasts, what day was this when she fasted? It was Pesach. And Mordechai comes over and says, but it's Pesach. And she says to him, Tzadik Shebi Yisrael, right? Holy Jew. If there are no Jews left, what do you need Pesach for? Which means the fasting of those days, Pesach is where we are celebrating our liberation, and she's saying, you better fast now before I go in. The whole community has to fast now. I'm going to fast as well. Presumably they ate at night. Presumably they ate at night because you cannot really fast 3 days or at least drink water. And you're right. Physically, she would not be all that strong. But I'm saying, again, I'm not... What I'm focusing on, this time, does she put on makeup? This time, does she put on perfume? This time, does she laugh at his jokes? This time, does she flirt with him? Yes. Because now she uses what she can use, and she uses what she has, because she realizes that the whole Jewish people's future are based upon her. But she also does something else, which, you know, in the words of Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin, and when I read this the first time, I'm telling you, I could not believe my eyes, and I read it a second time, and I read it a third time, and I said, he really said it. He says, there's a mitzvah to love God with all your heart and all your soul, even though that in the process you may lose your soul and may you lose your shechelik and olam haba. That's how much you have to lose God. And his evidence for this is, that's what he says, that's what it means, v'ahavtas Hashem l'kecha b'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha, even to the point of losing your neshama. And he says, like Esther goes in and says, kasher avadati avadati, as I'm lost, says that Esther, when she goes in willfully, is now about to break one of the three primary commandments in the Torah, that's Yehorg v'yavri, she'll let yourself be killed instead of doing. Again, till now she was raped. Now she's going to go in willfully. When she goes in now, she loses her chelak in olam haba. How is that for ruining the story completely? Esther going in willfully to save the Jewish people, at this point she loses her share in the world to come. That is what Rav Tzadok says. By the way, he backs down a bunch of pages later. Until I got to that further source, I was very, very troubled. But I will explain this more if I can. So what does Esther do when she goes in? She basically said, okay, and think about it. She could have let herself be killed in the very beginning. She would have had a share in the world to come. She would have been a martyr. She would have been respected by the entire Jewish community. Now she's going to go in willfully, devastating to her soul. She's going in, about to commit a sin. And she does something interesting. She says, Achashverosh, you know, with her shyest smile. Again, she could have been killed walking in there. But instead, he reaches out to her and says, well, you know, what can I do? But again, just think about the male ego. She's been playing hard to get all this point, and now he finally thinks that he got through to her. Now, she finally realized what a superior male specimen he is. And he says, what do you want? And she says, if it really means anything, if I mean anything to you, I'd love for you to come over tonight. And just now, think about Achashverosh. But then she adds in one more line. And that last line that she adds in is the thing which turns Achashverosh's world upside down. And what does she say? And bring that Haman fellow with you. Now, by saying this, did she get to him? And the answer is, of course she did, but again, I want to know what the evidence is. But before that, let's go back to our other friend, and who's that? Haman. If you were Haman, and if you were careful, if you were really politically careful, if the king and the queen are having a private dinner, and you get invited to come in, what should you say? Hold it, right there. This should not be happening. There's something wrong over here. What's going on? But the problem is that he is a megalomaniac. And therefore, the fact that he's invited in makes him feel good. So as I said, she uses his megalomania against this suspicious nature, this paranoid nature of Achashverosh. He comes in and he feels on top of the world. Haman feels great. Achashverosh, how does it impact him? He can't sleep that night. Why can't he sleep? Because he knows something's going on. But what can't he figure out? Who is it? Is the problem Haman? Is the problem Esther? Are Haman and Esther in this together? And by the way, the Gemara tells us that Esther she doesn't know what the end game is yet. The Gemara tells us that Esther is willing to try to seduce Haman because she thinks, at least if she gets rid of him, then maybe we'll be better off. Because she figures she slept with one pig, she'll sleep with the other pig. What difference does it make anymore? Again, when you realize what the Gemara is telling us, it again points out this terrible situation that Esther is in. But as I said, she starts off this plan, And you do get the sense that she doesn't have an end game. Why so? Because by the end of the first evening, what does she say? Ahasuerus wants to know what's going on. What is it? What do you want? And she's coy. What does she say? I'd like you to come back tomorrow night. She's looking for another opportunity. By the way, that was enough. Because as Haman, he's flying. And then he does something which again shows you his personality and shows you that she understood it exactly and shows you how he self-destructs. He walks out and he sees Mordechai. And Mordechai won't bow down to him. Now, why won't Mordechai bow down to him? Why won't Mordechai bow down to him? Well, what is that? Okay, good. Okay, maybe I'll try to explain that also soon, but not yet. Mordechai won't bow down to Haman. At this point, every Jew in the world is supposed to be killed within 11 months. If Haman were a little bit more careful, what would he say to himself? This guy Mordechai once helped the king. I better be careful. But instead, he walks out and he goes home and he says to who? He says to his loved ones and who else? And there was one guy now who always used to read by Oshul, and Ohavav v'ishto, right? Like, then this guy got divorced, so then I figured that maybe there was a message there. Anyway, it says that he has loved ones, people that love him. He has these children, he has this wife, and he goes home and he says, I have more power, I have more money, I have everything going for me. But what else does he say? Everything that I have is worthless. Again, flying high from being in the king's house, boom, all the way low down. Everything is worthless because it's the one thing he doesn't have. But by the way, do you realize how sick that is? This man has more going for him than any other person, probably in all of Tanakh. More power, more money. He has enough money he can bribe the king without thinking about it. He has money, he has power, he has supporters, he has everything going for him, and he completely self-destructs because the one thing he doesn't have, that there's a Jew who won't bow down to him, even though that Jew is supposed to be killed within 11 months, and not only will that Jew be killed, that Jew and his cousins and his other cousins and his entire extended family will soon be killed. I mean, if anybody else was in the situation of Haman, you walk out of the palace, you see Mordechai, you say, Mordechai, you're still not bowing down? If I were you, I'd start digging a grave. I would dig a mass grave. You're all going to be dead very soon. He doesn't have to go any further. But he does, and he self-destructs. And they give him, and his wife gives him this great idea. What's the plan? Hang Mordechai. So now, how do I now see again that Haman is manic depressive? Because now he gets manic. What happens when he gets manic? Again, he was all the way depressed, now he shoots up high. What happens when he gets manic? He goes to talk to the king. When does he go talk to the king? In the middle of the night. He can't sleep. So now it's interesting. Haman can't sleep, and Ahasuerus can't sleep. Of course, what does the Gemara really tell us here? Who's the melech over here? It's God who can't sleep. Right? And God is in the background the whole time. But Haman and Ahasuerus can't sleep. Why can't they sleep? Because of Esther. Esther starts this whole situation. Starts the situation that brings Haman so high. Starts the situation that sends Ahasuerus so low. And they're in a collision course. And by the way, it could have ended right then. Because Ahasuerus can't sleep and he says, there must be somebody who helped me. And they read the thing and they said, it's Mordechai. And if he walks in now and says, I want to kill somebody, I want to kill Mordechai, that would be the end of the story. But whoever wrote this obviously had a great sense of drama and decides to make it a little bit longer and maybe didn't realize that we were fasting as we're reading it. But the story continues a little bit longer. And then, and you have to appreciate this, when the king says, who's outside? I just gave it away. Do you think he says it really nice and calmly as he's smoking on a cigar, sitting in the palace? Oh, who's outside now? Or he's scared. I hear fear in his voice. He can't sleep. He's scared. Something's going on. And by the way, when you're paranoid, you get also very, very sensitive. They said it's Haman. Now, what's the problem with Haman right now? He's not sure if he can trust Haman. Why isn't he sure he can trust Haman? Because something's going on. Because Esther now has planted the seeds of doubt by inviting Haman, that maybe Haman is in on some kind of a plot. So he tests Haman. How does he test him? He said, somebody did me a favor, what should I do? And at that point, Haman, the megalomaniac, says the absolutely worst thing he can say to a paranoid king. And what's that? Let him wear the king's clothing, let him wear the king's crown, let him go on the king's horse, and let him ride around town. And let's be honest. Even though He doesn't say that the nation he wants to kill are the Jews. Do you get the feeling that Ahasuerus knows that Haman is a notorious anti-Semite? Do you think he's told his share of Jewish jokes along the way? Because you hear the words when he says, go do all the things you just now said and do it for Mordechai the Jew. And by the way, at this point, Haman shoots all the way down again. And by the way, the rest of the story is details, right? It's all details at this point. And you see exactly what Esther did. She understood the psychology of the males around her. She manipulates them. She brings them on a collision course. In the end, she saves the entire Jewish people. That's just the story. But I want to go a little bit further. There's a Gemara The Gemara asks a very strange question. The first question of the Gemara in Chulin and Kuflam at Testament Beis, it says, Moshe min HaTorah minayin. How do we ever know there'd be a man like Moshe? And it quotes the Pasuk, B'shagam hu abasar. The Gemara then asks, Haman min HaTorah minayin. How do we know there'd ever be a man like Haman? And it quotes the Pasuk, Hamin ha'etz, from the tree. Hamin ha'etz, talking about the Eitz Hadas Tovara. Then the Gemara says, Esther min HaTorah minayin. How do you ever know there'd be a person like Esther? It says, V'noch yastir astir. Panai, the word Esther is found in that verse. Mordechai min HaTorah minayin, and this is the funniest one, it says, Dichsiv, as it says, Mar Duror umitar Gaminon, but if you read it in the Targum Onkelos, it's Mar Dichia. Mar Dichia sounds like, if you're from Galicia, it sounds like Mordechai. And you read this Gemara, and you don't understand any of the questions. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I'll say very briefly, the four of them. Well, let's just start with Mordechai and Haman because they're easier, and then I'll get to the others. Sorry, Moshe. The question about Moshe is preposterous. How do you know be a man like Moshe? I can find the name Moshe in the Torah hundreds of times. Why did they ask me of Moshe? There is a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch that you're not allowed to say the name of an idolatry. You can't say the name of an idolatry. It's less it's a name which is written in the Torah. Moshe would have been perceived by the Egyptians as an idolatry. And if you're saying, how can I say such a thing? I'll say something which is very unfair, and that is somebody there had one of my books before. Go look in my book, Explorations. Take a look. I have a whole chapter on this explaining it. But very, very briefly, Pharaoh, as we see in the book of Yechezkel, thought that he was the god of the Nile. When his daughter takes Moshe out of the Nile, after you think about it, didn't he say to throw all the Jewish kids in the Nile? So you take a Jewish kid out of the Nile, what is he supposed to be? He's a Jewish kid. Why would she name him Moshe? Because I took him out of the Nile. Then you know it's a Jewish kid. It really seems a strange behavior. But when you realize that Paro imagined himself as a god of the Nile, so the idea of throwing the kids into the Nile was essentially the Nile will judge who will live and who will die. And when she says, I took him out of the Nile, she's claimed the Nile gave birth to him. If Paro was, right, right, God says to Yechezkel, Ben Adam, Omer LaParo, Melech Mitzrayim, right, and he says, about Paro, HaOmer, Li Ye'ori Vani Asitini. The Nile is mine, I created it. Paro claimed that he created the Nile, he's the God of the Nile. So what is his daughter claiming, and his daughter whose name is, what's her name? Actually, Bitya, it says in Divrei Yamim, Bitya, the daughter of a deity. He thinks he's a deity, he names his daughter the daughter of a deity. And what is Moshe? She's claiming that Moshe was given birth by the Nile, basically claiming that Moshe is part of the Egyptian pantheon of gods. That's so. Now the Gemara can ask Moshe min HaTorah minayin, answer the puzzle. Haman is also makes himself into an idolatry. So Haman, the Gemara also says no. Hamin ha'etz. We find the words Haman there as well. But you'll now ask me, what about Esther and what about Mordechai? What are they asking? So I will try to explain this. By the way, the association with Haman and with the Eitz Hadas Tov Hara is really very interesting, because what it's really doing is it's connecting Haman back to the Nachash. The Nachash was also somebody who spoke exactly like Haman. The Nachash says, you can eat from all the trees. What does he say? What does God say? God says you can eat from all the trees of the field except for one, and that one is going to kill you. What does the Nachash say? You can't eat from all the trees of the field. Did he tell the truth or not? Depends if you're a lawyer or not. Did he say, you can't eat from all the trees of the field, which means you can eat from all the trees except for one. Which one can't you eat from? The one that's going to kill you. But what does the Nachash do? The Nachash focuses on the one thing it doesn't have. Correct? The one thing it doesn't have. So therefore, on the same token, Haman focuses on the one thing he doesn't have, and that's what ends up destroying him. So therefore, there really is a parallel between the two. And of course, on a deeper level, the idea of the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra is that once we ate from this tree, we caused a confusion between good and evil, and that's the confusion that we live in, because when you eat the two together, there's confusion. And of course, the mitzvah of the Gemara tells us on Purim is Mechayev Inish Lefsumi B'Purya Ad Deloya Adabein Aruham and Lebaruch Mordechai. You eat till you no longer know the difference between good and evil. You eat till you're no longer affected from the Eitz Hadas Tov V'Ra. And of course, now you can understand the Midrashim that tell us the Eitz that he took goes back to an Eitz all the way in the Garden of Eden. And I'm not going to go talk more about this because if I keep on doing it, you really will think it's Purim. The pasuk that it quotes with Mordechai is a pasuk having to do with incense. And you say, so what is the incense? Mara dechia, mara deror. By the way, if you like gematrias, I don't know if you do. I made this one up. It's not a real one. Mar in gematria is 240. 240 is the gematria of Amalek. Dror means liberation. Mar dror is liberation from Amalek. Okay, if you like that. If you don't like it, ignore it. Because I know the suspicion is you can say anything that you want with gematria. What is the ketores? What does it have to do, or what is the smell, mar dror, what does it have to do with Mordechai, and what does this have to do with anything? Well, let's just go back to the Garden of Eden for a second. In the Garden of Eden, we sinned. What was the sin? Say, eating from the tree of knowledge, good and evil. The Bnei Yisachar points out that when we sinned, every single sense was corrupted. It says, she sees the tree, she listens to the words of the Nachash, she touches the tree, eats from the fruit. Everything was corrupted except for one sense. What was the one sense that wasn't corrupted? The one sense was a sense of smell. So over here, the antidote, the place where there's no sin, the place where there's no sin, the place where there's no corruption is Mordechai. We'll go a little bit deeper. What does Mordechai represent? Well, Mordechai represents, again, we'll do this on a couple of different levels. First of all, what's he called when he's introduced to us? Ish Yehudi, Hayayu B'Shushim, Ish Yemini. So make up the Gemara asks, make up your mind. Is he Ish Yehudi or is he Ish Yemini? What does Ish Yehudi literally mean? Don't tell me a Jewish guy. What does Ish Yehudi mean? A man from Yehuda. What does Ish Yemini mean? A man from Binyamin. So which is he? So don't answer the question. And again, I want you to think deeper. What exactly is the connection between Yehuda and Binyamin? The Beis HaMikdash is exactly. Is the, that's because you're American. The Beis HaMikdash is this place that Yehuda and Binyamin meet, which means that Mordechai represents the Beis HaMikdash. He represents this place of purity. What else are we told? Mordechai won't bow down. Why won't he bow down? Because he's from Binyamin. Every other tribe bowed down to Esav as soon as Esav and Yaakov met. They all bowed down. The one tribe that didn't bow down was Binyamin. Why doesn't Binyamin bow down? So you give me the answer, because he wasn't born yet. But we understand there's an idea called Ma'isa Avosim Labanim. If our ancestors did something, it has an effect on the future. The fact that they all bow down meant that everyone else will bow down. Mordechai, it says, Lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Which tense is that in? He will never bow down. Why? So the Arizal says, why? Because he's from Binyamin. Binyamin never bowed down, never will bow down. There's no control. Why? Because who is Mordechai? Mordechai is this one place there was never sin. What does Mordechai represent? He represents the Ketores. What does he represent? The sense of smell. That's the one place which is not corrupted, no bowing down, no sin. You still with me? Yes? So now it gets interesting. Have any of you ever heard this wonderful teaching that says Purim is like Yom Kippur? I've heard so many people quote this, and the one thing I've never seen any of them do is actually read what it says. Right? There's really a source that says this, and this is a source in the Zohar. It's in the Tikkuni Zohar on page 57b, for those of you who want to follow up at home. It says, then this is Yom Kippur, and Yom Kippur is the day that the Kohen Gadol puts on the clothing, the holy clothing, their holy clothing, because they're clothing of forgiveness, clothing of kapara. By the way, to make this easy for all of you, what does the Kohen Gadol do when he goes inside into the inner sanctum? What does he do then? What does he bring in? He brings in the incense, the Ketores, which means now you already understand that there's some kind of a connection over here with the Ketores. But that's not, I mean, it's much better than that. It's much better than that. And again, there's many, many interpretations what the connection is. But as I said, I want to do something very simple and read what it actually says. And then we'll try to understand the implication. It says that the Kohen Gadol will go in, and now it enumerates the various clothing. And it says, and how do we know this? Where do we learn this from? The idea of the Kohen Gadol putting on all these clothing, the clothing of forgiveness. And by the way, there were so many easier verses it could have quoted than the verse that it chooses. And I'll read it to you first in the original. V'iyah yom ha-kippurim v'kad itkashet kadmei b'levushin shafirin, beautiful clothing, de'inun levushin kapara. What makes the clothing beautiful? That they're clothing of forgiveness. And I remember in the beginning, Achashverosh put these clothing on. Itkari tzitz dilei, mitznafet dilei, avnet dilei, iyu kalila ba'arbi bigdei lovin, misitra d'yamina, ba'arbi bigdei zov, misitra d'smola, b'hu zimna de'itkashet be'ilein levushin de'kapara, itmarba. And the idea of putting on these clothing, that's what the Pasuk says, Batilbosh Esther Malchus. That's what verse does it quote? That Esther put on the royal clothing. Do you understand what this just now said? Uvahon ilait lefnei v'lefnim. Esther puts on, that's what it says in the Megillah, that Esther puts on the clothing and then she goes in to see Achashverosh. And it says, and that's what it means, v'hon ala'it l'fnai v'lefnim, and then she goes into the inner sanctum. Hadahu d'chsiv v'tamod b'chatzar beis ha-melech p'nimis. And that's what it means, she goes into the inner courtyard of the king. And what does it say in the next line? Purim etgra'et al-shem yom ha-kippurim. Purim is called because of Yom Kippur, because there's something connecting over here. What's the connection that the Zohar is telling us here? And this is the thing that I've never seen anybody quote. If they just quote Purim like Yom Kippur, and then they start giving you all kinds of drushes for this. What does the Zohar actually say? Why is Purim like Yom Kippur? Because Esther was the Kohen Gadol. And you're going to tell me, what are you talking about? Esther's the Kohen Gadol. Say, what in the world are you talking about? So I have one advantage. What's the advantage? It actually said it. Okay, so that's one. But what does it mean? So I want to go back to Rav Tzaddok. Rav Tzaddok said that Esther, when she went in and she sinned, she lost her share in the world to come. And then in the next line, he says something which is equally interesting. And he says that when Aaron sinned with the golden calf, why does Aaron sin? He sins in order to save the Jewish people. Because he knows they've already killed Hur, and if they kill him and then worship idolatry, they'll never be forgiven. So instead he says, I'll do it to save them from doing it. And then Rav Tzaddik says the following, don't think for a second that Aaron became the Kohen Gadol despite the fact that he worshipped the Egel Azov, the golden calf. He says that Aaron became the Kohen Gadol because he worshipped the golden calf. Because when he worshipped, he realized that he was going to lose his share in the world to come. But he loved the Jewish people so much that he was willing to sacrifice this world and the next for the Jewish people. And what the Zohar is telling us over here is that Esther loved the people so much that she was willing to go in and to lose her share in the world to come to save the Jewish people. And the Zohar is telling us that when Esther walks in to the inner sanctum, don't think for a second that she went in for a one-night stand. Don't think for a second she went in for a fling, or what my American students today would call to hook up. That's not what it means. Esther goes in with the same kavana that the Kohen Gadol would go in to save the entire Jewish people on Yom Kippur. She goes in, and if you think about it, when the Kohen Gadol goes in, if he makes one mistake, what happens? He'll be killed. If Esther goes in and makes one mistake, what's going to happen? She'll be killed on the spot. But Esther goes in with the same kavana of the Kohen Gadol, and that's what saves the entire Jewish people. At the end, as I said, God understands people's intentions, and God has the ability of saying, that there's such an idea of Naveru Lishma, a sin done for the sake of heaven. And let's not confuse ourselves. Most of us sin, we don't have to confuse ourselves in thinking we're doing it for the sake of heaven. We have a hard time doing our mitzvahs for the sake of heaven, right? Esther, it says, that when she does this sin for the sake of heaven, in the end, God accepts this and accepts the avoda. But what the Zohar is telling us, that's this whole secret of Yom Kippur, was the ability of Aaron to somehow turn around the sin of the golden calf and become the representative of the people only because his heart was so pure. And Esther's heart is so pure, and that's how she ends up becoming the quote-unquote Kohen Gadol. So now we have a story of, forget about feminism now, that's what I said. According to the Zohar, Esther is a Kohen Gadol. Esther goes in and saves the entire people. But you also now realize that there's something which is very sad about the story. It's the tragedy of a Jewish girl whose life is lost. What does she want? She wants to stay and she wants to live in her own Jewish community. She wants to bake her challah and she wants to light her candles and she wants to do the mitzvahs that a woman is supposed to do. She doesn't want anything to do with this. And she finds herself thrust into this situation and she ends up brilliantly looking for this plan to understand how to take down this incredible adversary, Haman. And Haman is, again, the same as the Nachash, and the Haman is the Yetzirah, and she understands how to destroy this. She herself ends up functioning like the Kohen Gadol with complete purity, and that's what her real name is. Her real name isn't Esther. Esther is when she's hidden. What's her real name? Hadassah. What's a Hadass? What's Hadass? That's one of the four species. Which one is it? It's the one that has the good smell. Because Esther ultimately is this incredibly good smell, because Esther ultimately is the Ketores, she ultimately is the Avoda of going in into the inner part of the Beis HaMikdash. The story of Esther has incredible consequences for us, because we were saved, and we celebrate being saved. But on the other hand, we can't get to Purim without the day before commemorating, remembering that there was once a Jewish girl named Esther and fasting for Esther. Because there's something sad over here. You know, living in Israel, and I'll end with this. Living in Israel, we have the same experience. And this is one thing that the modern state did, which I think was very appropriate. We have a day which is a very happy day, and that's Yom HaTzmaut. We all get off that day, by the way. You know, nobody goes to work. But the day before Yom HaTzmaut is Yom HaZikaron. Yom HaZikaron is a day where people go to cemeteries. People go to cemeteries, military cemeteries, and they commemorate the lives of all the young people that were killed trying to defend the land. Which means we can't celebrate our liberation until first we celebrate what the price that was paid for this. And apparently whoever made this up either had some kind, I don't want to say Ruach HaKodesh, had some kind of insight, but that's exactly what the Jewish people did. But and again, it's fascinating. Tanis Esther is a mystery. People don't know when it started or where it started, why it started. But maybe that last phrase is wrong. Maybe we do know why it started. It started because the Jewish people who understand the story of Esther, understand the price that she paid, understood that in order to have this incredible salvation at the end, the salvation had a price, and that price was a life. And that life was a girl whose name was Hadassah, a nice Jewish girl named Hadassah. And she was hidden, and when she was hidden, her name is Esther, and she was dressing up in clothing that wasn't hers. And you may think that she was dressing and acting like a wayward woman when she goes in, but the Zohar says, don't you dare look at her that way, because when she went in, she was dressed like the Kohen Gadol. Thank you very much. Sure.
If there are any questions, I'll probably be more than happy to.
No, I didn't say more than happy. Just happy.
I said more than one.
Yeah. No, I didn't say more than happy. Okay,
what happened to the rest of where we leave off?
As far as we know, she continues with Achashverosh the rest of her life, and her son, Daryavish, is the one who completes building the Beis HaMikdash, or gives us permission.
Just one more question. I'm sorry. I'm not sure whether the rabbi answered why she originally went there.
Mordechai told her to. Mordechai said, you should go. He must have had a sense that it's not a coincidence. No Ruach HaKodesh, or no prophecy, but he had a sense that this is the way for things to work. Thank you very much.